Well, England have only gone and done it. Gareth Southgate's side find themselves on the brink of history on Sunday night as they face a winner-takes-all final up against Italy at Wembley. And here on our Euro 2020 final preview on the Squawker Talker podcast, we'll be previewing that game and hopefully, potentially, answering that all-important question of, come on, we all know the question by now, is it finally coming home? And alongside previewing the final, we'll also be looking back at two brilliant semi-finals and asking what next for Spain after Luis Enrique's side bowed out on penalties against the Italians. And we're also focusing on a fantastic summer for Denmark and what the next 12 months hold for them. That's all to come in part one of the show. And then to wrap things up, we'll also be previewing that other big, big final this weekend. You might have heard about it, as on the other side of the Atlantic, there is the very small matter of Brazil against Argentina in the Copa America, as Mr. Free Transfer himself looks to secure his first ever major international honour. Right then, an absolute stack of stuff to get through. My name's Fergal Brennan, and joining me for this All or Nothing podcast ahead of the final is Squawker's main man, Mohamed Butt. Mo, how's things?
You know, I'm still tired, like always, but I'm buzzing. I'm really hyped. It's last night is still blowing my mind, kind of. There's just so much to do, so much to look forward to, so much to talk about. Let's get on with it, lads. Let's get into it.
And representing the Celtic Italians for one night only, we have Ewan McTare and Alan Feely. Ewan, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I think I said on Monday that semi-final week is the best week of any tournament, and for the Euros and the Copa America, I think that was true. So, it was a lot of fun. Lots to unpack.
Alan, it all comes down to this. One more game left in the European Championships. Excited?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very, very interesting week, without a doubt. Some fantastic football played. And even better weekend in prospect. Brazil-Argentina, first final since 2007 in the Copa America. Neymar and Messi going for the first ever major international title with their countries. And obviously, of course, Italy-England is probably one of the best European Championship finals we can remember in recent times, you know. I'm buzzing for it. I got vaccinated about 2 hours ago, so if I come up with any nonsense over the course of the next hour, I can blame it on that and not my general deficiencies. So I'm good to go.
Right, so whichever way it goes, Mo, it's going to be a historic night on Sunday. England 2-1 winners after extra time over Denmark. An own goal, unfortunately, for Simon Kjær cancelled out Mikael Damsgaard's free kick. The first goal that England have conceded at the Euros. Well, Harry Kane, despite missing, shall we say, a slightly controversial penalty, tapped in the rebound to put England in their first ever European Championship final and a first major final since, obviously, 1966. Before we get into, you know, the actual detail and the game and the players, let's have a bit of fun. Mo, you've been a bit like a coiled spring during the tournament. It's now all or nothing on Sunday. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I can't even get the words out. I'm feeling very good. Really,
that's
positive.
How good you're feeling.
Because if you recall, no, honestly, it's such a bizarre feeling, because on the one last night I was doing player ratings, so you have to stay calm, because otherwise if you start getting delirious, you start typing gibberish and then your ratings don't make any sense. So I was trying to keep it calm, you know, having a bit of fun on Twitter with just some venting, but then like, okay, back to the ratings, stay calm. I went on the Ranks FC podcast last night, so I'm, again, I'm trying to stay calm. And now I'm sitting here in the day, I'm just sitting here like prepping for this pod, and I'm like, oh my God, England in the final. Holy crap. It's like, because you know, Italian 90, lost it, right? Semi-final, heartbreak. You know, Euro 96, lost it, semi-final, heartbreak. And possibly worse than Italian 90, even though that was the World Cup, because it was at home. It was at Wembley. It was a home tournament. And then 2018, you know, 22 years later, semi-final again, and then absolutely fudged up themselves, right? Completely self-inflicted nonsense. From the trinity of nonsense with Walker, Stones and Pickford, and messed up again and you're out, right? And so it's just, you're just thinking, England just have this sort of Solskjaer-esque hump, can't get over semi-finals, right? It's like, you know, and they get to play Denmark and you're thinking, all right, here we go. This is a winnable game. Denmark are very good, but it's a winnable game. And then they go 1-0 down. First free kick scored in the tournament. First free kick scored either the Copa or the Euros that isn't scored by Lionel Messi. Mikael Damsgaard, absolute, what a dipper that is. Honestly, like, that thing's like 5 yards over the crossbar and goes, phew, dips in. Although, you know, once again, we have to say baby arms, you know, a longer armed, longer limbed goalkeeper would have saved that, you know. And sorry, Jordan, you've had a great tournament, but this is what I've said, didn't I say it? The Pickford wobbles. We had one in the year, we had one against Ukraine, we had three against Denmark. What's going to happen in the final? Are we actually going to see a full on Pickford moment in the final? I'm very worried, but you know, I'm positive in general because the lads just showed so much togetherness and spirit, and they messed up, and then they came back gut check time, right? You're wondering how can England cope with adversity because they've not really had any. So far, so they've defended well, and most of their problems have been their own making just because Southgate has been so conservative. But they went behind you thinking, oh, here we go. What are you really made of now? And they responded brilliantly. They got an equaliser. Okay, fortunate own goal. But frankly, Sterling had a chance like literally like 30 seconds earlier, which he inexplicably shot right at Schmeichel. So they were building momentum anyway. Kane with a beautiful pass, one of only two good things he did in the night. And it was, you're just thinking, okay, here we go. And then second half we'll discuss later because that's more about tactical in-depth stuff, but then, you know, extra time you got the penalty, and again we'll discuss that in a minute, but it's just I'm feeling confident because like I said earlier in one of these podcasts, I can't remember which one it was, if there's one midfield that can actually handle Italy, it's England's, because what we need to do to Italy's midfield to stop them, as we saw that with Spain in another semi-final which we'll discuss as well, is you need to press Italy's midfield, and if you can press them, you can disrupt them, and England can press them.
Alan, looking at the game, again, we find ourselves talking about England and we're talking about reactions and mentality, arguably more than the football that was actually played. And Mo is right. This was the big talking point before the game and during the game. Either side of Damsgaard's goal, a lot of England fans will be looking at this and saying, how are we going to react to a situation? How are we going to react if we concede a goal or if we start playing badly? And as Mo said, there was the reaction and England went in 1-1 at half-time. But these questions do continue to keep being answered. And this kind of holy grail of chasing this perfect performance and perfect result, in Gareth Southgate's mind and in the majority of England fans' minds, every result in the knockout stages is a perfect result because mentality has won the day time and time again.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that the kind of flaws that we maybe pinpointed earlier in the tournament in terms of the lack of scintillating football they were playing, the over-conservatism, is becoming a virtue as we get to the business end of things, you know, come against top teams. I mean, I don't think Denmark are a top team, but they're a very, very good team, and they played some very, very good stuff yesterday. But I think, you know, looking at that final against Italy, they're definitely in good shape going into it, and they definitely have to be considered favourites because of their strength and depth, but also the fact that they prove they can respond to adversity, they can handle it calmly, and they're not afraid of the occasion. They're not going to let emotions get to themselves, you know. I was struck towards the end of that game last night that they were confident keeping the ball. It wasn't like they were knocking it long and panicking, you know, the occasion getting to them. They were playing very, very cool and collected and seeing out the game and managing the game. And I think that, you know, Southgate is clearly in charge, taking off Jack Grealish after bringing him on to kind of protect the lead. It was a bold call because if Denmark had equalised, then there would have been serious question asked, you know. But I think that, yeah, I think it's not spectacular. It's not scintillating. It's not, you know, thrilling in many ways, but it does get the job done. And at the end of the day, when you're this far in the competition, playing in these big, big games in front of an almost full Wembley, you know, that's all you want, really. I think the fans will get behind results football when they're delivering results.
Ewan, looking at the situation with Grealish, as Alan said, he got subbed on and then got subbed off for Trippier with this idea of protecting the league, protecting the lead and managing the game to the end of 120 minutes. It's still a very strange situation with Southgate. He gave the statement after the Germany game about the system and the personnel that he picked that if they'd lost that game, he would have been, quote, dead. And as Alan says, you get the same sense with the Grealish double change last night that he's still feeling the pressure that despite the fact that he's making calls that maybe a lot of fans wouldn't have made as kind of armchair managers, despite the fact he's getting them right, he still feels the vulnerability of his position, despite the fact he's just got England to their first ever European final.
Yeah, I mean, he's aware of the criticism, but I don't think he cares. I don't think he's paying any attention to that. Southgate is doing what he thinks is best to win the tournament, not what he thinks the majority will agree with, the majority of fans on their sofas, the majority of people writing the newspaper columns. You know, you can't manage England by committee. You can't manage it with the whole population coming together. What's the consensus? That's not going to work. So if you make decisions to please people, that's what England have done so many times in the past. He's making decisions that he thinks are best to win each individual match. He knows the squad better than anybody, and the players don't care. I mean, Southgate explained the Grealish decision really well, that, you know, he wasn't going to take off Sterling because he was just fantastic. Kane, you keep on as well. So he was like, well, if I'm taking somebody off because we've got the goal we put Grealish on for, then it's him or Foden. Foden came on after, so it's Grealish. And Grealish didn't care at all. Grealish told Southgate, no problem, Gaffer, we're in the final. That's exactly what Southgate said Grealish told him. So the players don't care. Southgate doesn't care. There may be criticism. He may be aware of it, but he's not paying attention to it. And that's a big difference, I think, with this England team compared to some England teams of the past.
Yeah, no, when you look at the Grealish point, that could have been a flashpoint. Like, this is the one thing I've noticed as well. I've mentioned it before. Everyone's happy in the England squad. That kind of thing could be a real flashpoint. You're taking off this amazingly popular player. The stadium, the crowd rises like he's the Pope when he walks onto the pitch. It's like, ah, it's him, it's here. And you know, he doesn't that's not gone to his head. Like, he doesn't think he deserves to start. He doesn't think he wants to play, wants to start, but he doesn't, like, think he deserves it. And he gets taken off. And, you know, I know he didn't mean to, but that is humiliating. You know, coming on 30 minutes later, you get taken off. Now, I understand. I agree with it, because I understand. Normally, I'm all about the team, get Kane off the field. But if it's extra time and there's a possibility of a shootout, you keep Kane on the field. So, I actually understand the decision. I think, you know, what else could you do? You couldn't take Sterling off, for sure. So, okay, cool, fine. You make that change. But what I loved about it was the fact that, as you say, even Grealish was like, yeah, okay, we're in the final. That's fine. I don't mind. It's about the team. And that, I think, speaks volumes to Gareth Southgate's man management, Gareth Southgate's leadership. Because, you know, we've all fallen over ourselves praising Luis Enrique and Roberto Mancini this tournament. Rightfully so. Rightfully so. But Southgate has done really well with the man management. Tactically, I mean, we'll get onto that in a second about what his limitations are or are not. But man managing wise, he's been phenomenal with this tournament. He's kept the whole squad happy. He's gotten everyone involved. I think every outfield player, with the exception of Marcus Rashford, Ben Chilwell, and Connor Cody, has had a moment in the tournament. Like, okay, Rashford's come on, but he hasn't really had a moment. Like, everyone's had a sort of featured moment to come on and contribute. So that's really good squad management, in all honesty. And so, you know, you just can't help but be impressed by Southgate and the way he's managed it. Managed his squad, managed expectations. You think about the way that England have fallen apart in the past, the Wags escapade in 2006 with the whole, and then Fabio Capello laying the law down, no wives, no girlfriends, no fun. And it's just, and you know, and these two extremes where England are either massively, you know, living this Dionysian lifestyle, or they're just completely locked down in boot camp mode. It's like, no, you can actually just live a normal life at your tournament. And look at the players, they're having a great time. Bukayo Saka on the unicorn is just going to become a meme throughout the ages.
For all eternity.
Just having a great time. And it's just, yeah, no, honestly. And it's just, they're having a really, really good time and they're relaxed and they're happy. The same way that Chiellini, and we'll get onto that in a minute, the same way that Giorgio Chiellini just seemed relaxed and happy before Italy shootout with Spain. And that to me is why they're the two-time sides in the final. They're relaxed and they're calm.
Looking at England, before we move on to Italy, Alan, arguably, you kind of hard pushed to look for glaring weaknesses. We've kind of discussed Southgate and some of the issues in terms of selection or maybe systems, but the one thing that was apparent in patches when Denmark did look to be getting the upper hand last night was movement. And this is something we've addressed a few times. We know that with pacing behind Kyle Walker in that kind of strange fullback sweeper role, he tends to deal with that threat quite well. But Poulsen, Damsgaard and Brathwaite, none of them are electric, but they do have very good movement. They're able to swap roles and look to move in and out of each other's positions. Italy find themselves in a similar position, and whichever three Mancini goes for, obviously if he mirrors the semi-final and sticks with Chiesa, Immobile and Insigne, they're all about movement and interchangeability. That, for me, as we move into the final, is still the big question mark over England. Passing on players from midfield, Rice or Phillips, calling to the centre-backs and saying, he's your man, and vice versa, players moving into the space and being picked up. When we look at the final, going forward, England do look relatively efficient. There's goals there, there's movement there, there's pace there. But that little space, that golden little area at the back of Declan Rice and in front of Maguire and Stones is still a concern.
It is, but I think, you know, as mentioned in the Totally Football Show this morning, it's like having Kyle Walker is almost like having a cheat code in many ways, because you can get away with kind of pressuring a bit higher because you have his recovery pace. You know, I mean, I know with Lorenzo Insigne, he's very rapid. Chiesa too, maybe less so. But I still think that, you know, the form that Luke Shaw is in terms of occupying kind of the final third, and also Kyle Walker's ability in covering, is a real benefit, you know. I think that Insigne could do serious damage. I think he could be the danger man in this game. I think that, you know, if he can drift inside and kind of go at maybe John Stones, I think there's a weakness there and that hasn't been exploited yet. And I think Chiesa can also be a very potentially, you know, effective operator in a different way. I think that Insigne will dominate more in terms of aesthetics, in terms of actual gameplay, but Chiesa is the man who can deliver results, and he's already proven that he can deliver on the biggest stage, you know. So I think there's certainly a weakness there. I think that there's a look quite strong, and I think that Walker's recovery pace is a massive asset, as well as the kind of, you know, occupying movements that the fullbacks will be doing going forward. But there's definitely a space there to get at them for sure.
Ewan, looking at Italy, England, we keep talking about the test that they've passed and the questions that they've answered. There's arguably no more battle-hardened team than Italy in the tournament. They've been excellent right since the first ball was kicked, and obviously they were there on the opening night and got 3 points in Rome. Looking at the knockout stages, they've gone through extra time 3 times. They've had to go the full 12 rounds against everybody, and then obviously winning against Spain on penalties. What we kind of see now in this final is no side that have played absolutely scintillating, cut the opposition to ribbons football, but have both played fantastic systems, very well coached, very well implemented systems. But Italy, in terms of questions being asked and answered, you do get the sense that they've had more questions thrown at them than England necessarily.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you look at the opposition they've had to play from the quarters on, to have to play that really strong Belgium side, to have to play Spain, to go all the way to penalties. I mean, Bonucci spoke after the Spain one and said this was the toughest game of my career. This is Bonucci, who's played many, many really tough games, really important nights, and he says this was his toughest one, and they won. So to come through a test like that, I think builds a lot of character, the same way that England have built a lot of character, I think, by going to extra time, by going behind, coming back. So you've got two teams who I think have been probably the two best teams overall in the tournament, in the final. Two teams who are coming after a draining semi-final. Maybe that extra day of rest that Italy have could actually be useful. I mean, England do have the home advantage. They've not travelled much this tournament. Neither have Italy travelled too much, and they'll have that extra day of rest. So both these teams come in, both will be determined. Both these teams, I think, will know if we go behind, that's okay. We can deal with that. We've come through adversity. We've made it here. So that's why this final is just so difficult to predict. I mean, there's two teams that I think are just very evenly matched. If you look as well at the sort of makeup of the squad, you've got a lot of young players, a lot of quick, fast players. You've got sturdy defences. Italy have a sturdy defence just because they've always been good at that. They've got Chiellini and Bonucci. England, like Mo was saying, have, you know, individuals who are just having some of the best summers of their careers, you know, are playing above themselves, a lot of the members of that back four. And then both of these squads have a lot of young players who were playing in their respective countries' second or third divisions, like literally 2 or 3 years ago. So a lot of players who are on the up in their careers. This is the biggest moment they've had so far. And oof, it's a coin toss. I mean, it's two very evenly matched teams. And I think, you know, looking at the tournament as a whole, this is the final that we probably deserve.
Alan, looking at the lineups and in terms of how the two teams are going to play, before the semi-final against Spain, there was maybe a couple of question marks about how Italy's attack would line up. We know what the midfield is going to be, and we knew that was going to be such a big battle, almost like a chess match up against Spain's midfield. But Mancini now looks settled on this three of Insigne and Chiesa either side of Immobile. That was what he started against Belgium and then replicated that again against Spain. Neither sides really have a massive amount of selection dilemmas going into this. Do you think that system of Immobile looking to, you know, create space via his movement to allow almost an inversion of Chiesa to come in off one side, Insigne to come in off the other? We saw that brilliant goal that he scored against Belgium. That's Italy's best way of playing, because in terms of movement, that's how they're going to get the better of England.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the strongest lineup at this point of the tournament. Obviously, it's a shame that Locatelli has come out of the starting 11, but I think Verratti has been good since he came in. To be fair, I know that Mo was kind of strong feelings about Verratti in many ways, but I think he does bring something to the starting 11. You know, I think he does bring balance to midfield. I think he'll be pivotal against England. I'm really interested to see how that battle goes, because I know that Calvin Phillips and Declan Rice have been very, very solid defensively, very, very responsible. I think Declan Rice in particular has been playing a very mature tournament. You know, we forget that it's really his first major tournament, you could say. And he's been very good. But I wonder, like, I don't think they have the chops to compete with Italy's midfield in the same way that Spain did. I think that Spanish midfield is top class, you know, Koke, Pedri and Sergio Busquets. So I'd expect Italy to have the better of the ball and more of the midfield possession and win that battle a bit. But at the same time, I think that England are much more dangerous in the final third than Spain are. So while England are maybe weaker in midfield, I think they're stronger in the final third. And I think they will get opportunities there, you know. I think that Sterling is like a man possessed this summer. Whether he's playing for a move, whether he's playing for his country or whatever, he's been absolutely phenomenal. And I think he's been the best player England have all summer. Kane looks like determined to get another golden boot and break Gary Lineker's record of goal scoring in major tournaments. You know, so it's really finely poised. There's so many variables there, to be honest. I agree with you, and I think it's almost impossible to call. I think if you compare the goalkeepers, you know, as an Everton fan, I've watched Jordan Pickford a lot. He has a mistake in him. He always has. He's shown moments of insecurity, whereas somebody like Donnarumma seems ice cold, you know? So I think a lot of it depends on individual performances. It depends on how the systems match up, who wins the key battles in midfield and the fullback positions. How Immobile can occupy the centre backs. There's just so much in play. And like, as well as it being a culturally rich final between two of the, you know, greatest football nations in the history of the game, it's also a tactical battle, a battle between two very competent coaches and two teams that have given us so much this summer, this tournament, and are really finely matched. So I'm really excited for this game, to be honest with you.
Before we get into predictions, I'll give you a minute or two to stew on that. Just a look at the semi-finalists who obviously bowed out, Denmark and Spain. Mo, Denmark last night and the performances throughout the tournament have been... It's a difficult one to kind of frame because they have been a credit, but it's very difficult to say they've been a credit without sounding a little bit condescending, because they've actually been excellent in terms of the football that they've played and the way that the players have represented the country. Obviously, the story surrounding Eriksen dominated the early days of Euro 2020 for them. But since then, they've gone on and on and on and got stronger. And Alan mentioned before the way we kind of see Denmark as a national side. We don't see them maybe as a member of the European elite. But on the back of this tournament now, individual performances, Schmeichel, Kjær, Christensen, Delaney, Mikkel Damsgaard up top, they now have to be considered as maybe not being in the top three, four, five nations in Europe, but they are right there. They're no longer just, you know, happy to participate, maybe get a knockout stage. They're now a force within European football. And hopefully when Christian Eriksen comes back, that will only strengthen them.
Yes, to a degree, but also you have to be wary of that because Kasper Schmeichel is not young. Simon Kjær is not young. I mean, these guys aren't old, but they're not that young. And also, if we're being perfectly honest, Yannick Vestergaard is a glaring weak spot for any genuinely elite team that's going to take advantage of him. Harry Kane can barely run. Harry Kane was having fun with Vestergaard yesterday. And that's not to say Kane was playing well necessarily, but Vestergaard couldn't get a handle on Kane. He damn sure couldn't get a handle on Sterling. And then, you know, it's telling that the penalty came from Vestergaard's side because everyone else was having to pitch in to help Vestergaard out because he couldn't live with Sterling one-on-one. I think Denmark deserve a lot of credit. I think they played excellent football. And last night, they just were unfortunate that, I mean, they got injuries. They ran out of steam. And Gareth Southgate obviously committed to shutting down Joachim Mailer with Kai Saka, which worked. You know, Mailer didn't really play until Saka left the field. And by then, England was settled in their ways anyway. So, you know, they were unlucky in the way it all ran out of steam in the end. But they're a serious team. They're a very well-organized team. They've got very good players. Brathwaite does really, really well. Really good tactical job. Yeah, you see that thing where he flipped it over Declan Rice? I was like, what is this Ronaldinho? What's going on here? is this guy possessed by the spirit of Ronaldo or Ronaldinho? It was crazy. But no, he does a really good tactical job for them, even though he's not really what you'd call a big name or a good reputation. The key to Denmark persisting is going to be Dolberg scoring goals, right? That's what it's all about. If you can... Dolberg can keep scoring goals, they can keep winning games. That's the most important thing for Denmark, because the rest of the team, Damsgaard, is young enough. Højbjerg is young enough. You know, the Leicester team is all in I don't want to say primes, but they're all in enough of an age. And Kjær at least is a centre-back and Kasper is a goalkeeper, so they can play on until they're a bit older anyway. And Christensen is a phenomenal player. Phenomenal player. So he's emerging as the next leader. It's just a matter of can Dahlberg keep scoring goals, because he did really well this tournament, got 3 goals, but Jussi Poulsen got 3 goals. That's why they made it as far as they did. Yeah. If those two don't show up for the tournament, then Denmark don't make it out of the group. Those two showed up. Can they keep showing up? That's what's going to decide how good Denmark are.
You know what else might be key for Denmark is going into the World Cup is the substitutions rule. If it goes back from 5 to 3 subs, that could really help Denmark, because I think their 11 is really good. And we saw in this game as well, their 12th player, their 13th player, fine. What really, I think, changed the game in extra time was when England bring on the 14th and 15th and 16th players, you see the difference there in the squad depth. You know, England could bring on Phil Foden, Kieran Trippier as their last subs, you know. Denmark was bringing on Jonas Wind. You know, it's. I think if the substitutions go back to just 3 subs in the World Cup, maybe, and England can't exploit their squad depth in each individual game, teams like that, teams like France, teams like Germany, teams like Spain that have all this depth, that could really help the smaller sides again, like Denmark, because I think that's where they really struggled in the end of extra time in this one, was that 14th, 15th, 16th sub. They just didn't have that.
Alan, looking at Spain, again, we find ourselves in a position after a major tournament for Spain where the manager is going to lose or likely lose some huge players, if not before the next tournament, definitely before the next Euros. And the focus now falls on Alba and Busquets and the succession plan that Enrique has in place. Obviously, after Euro 2012, there was this slew of great players that were moving towards the end of their international careers. But in terms of their importance within the current squad, Busquets and Alba are as important, if not more important, than some of those incredible players in the 2012 squad. And by that, I mean there was players in a position to step in and step up. This time round, that's not the case. And Enrique's got a big job on his hands to rebuild certain parts of his team ahead of the World Cup.
But if you look into that transition after 2012, those players didn't step up. Like the likes of Thiago, David De Gea didn't step up and fill the boots, you know? So I think that it's not a disaster. I think, you know, Alba is less of a loss because you have Jose Luis Gaya there as a left back and he's a very competent option. I think Barcelona would try and sign him this summer if they weren't so financially hamstrung. He's captain of Valencia. He'll probably stay there next season, I'd imagine. He's a very, very talented guy and he's good for years younger than Alba as well. Busquets is the issue, without a doubt. I think that we saw how important he was when he came into the team against Slovakia. He just changed the game for Spain because in the absence of Sergio Ramos, they don't have that confident vocal leader who's been there and done that on the pitch. We were discussing pre-podcast and like Alba isn't that leader. He's too, I don't know, I think maybe you could say too focused in his own game, too kind of, you know, corrosive presence, too chirpy a character. Yeah, too introverted maybe, but like he kind of complains a lot and he's very kind of, you know, contrary in many ways. I just don't think he's a captain material, whereas Busquets definitely is. Rodri is the alternative, the obvious alternative in that holding midfield position. And he just hasn't delivered yet for Spain in the way that Busquets has. Obviously, the likes of Pedri and Ansu Fati are two genuine world-class players in the making, I believe. I mean, hopefully Fati can recover from his injury. It looks like he'll be back for pre-season for Barcelona when they return next week. Working in his own in the beginning, but soon to recover fully. Hopefully he'll get back to the level he was at before I got injured against Real Betis last November. And Pedri obviously has kind of won the footballing world's acclaim. But aside from those players, I think they have good players who have a couple of pivotal years coming up. The likes of Mikel Oyarzabal, Dani Olmo, Pau Torres, Eric Garcia. Players who have the potential to become top class players but aren't there yet. So I think the next couple of years, the next 18 months in their development is pivotal. If Spain are to kind of consolidate the progress this summer and really return to the top flight of world football. What I will say is, as a final point, that Luis Enrique is the right man to do it. I think he's a phenomenal person, a phenomenal leader. He's proven his chops this summer. He's, like Gareth Southgate, has ridden criticism and delivered when it counted. And I just think that he's a true star of Spain this summer, I think.
Gents, I think we've delayed it long enough. The inevitable has come round. Ewan, I'm going to start with you. Euro 2020 final, as you yourself said, and I would agree, the two on-form teams, the two best teams at the tournament, quite rightly going head-to-head in the final. How is it going to go down? Mancini or Southgate?
I think this one goes to extra time. It maybe even goes to penalties. And both, I think England do it. I have this fear. I have this great fear that they do it, and they do it in some epic way in a penalty shootout. If Jordan Pickford can just, you know, extend his arms just a little bit, you know, just reach out and, you know, get his finger to one of those shots. Reach it. Touching me, touching you, touching the ball, winning it is coming home.
Wow. And it sounds even more chilling in your accent. It makes it sound terrifyingly real. Alan, I'm going to throw it over to you. That's one gritted teeth vote for England. Are you back in England or are you going for the Italians?
Well, I backed them for the semi-final, so I can't be accused of being a bitter Irishman, although I am a bitter Irishman. I just can't see past Italy. I backed them before the tournament, and I think they'll do it. I think that this trophy is on... Their name is on the trophy. I think that Mancini is going to do it. And I think that this team are just... They'll die on the pitch for the Italian flag, it seems like. So I'm going to stick with Italy.
Mo, you're looking very relaxed on screen there. Are you as relaxed ahead of this? Are you that confident that England are going to do it?
Oh, God, no, I'm not confident at all. Are you crazy? No, this is huge. This is a massive game. England would have much rather played Spain. They'll never admit it. And obviously, with Spain, there would have been the terror of being dominated by Busquets and Pedri. But Spain's weaknesses play right into England's hands, right? So they would have had the wide-open defensive, awful profligate attack. Maguire would just rebuffed everything. Sterling would have killed Eric Garcia on the break. But Italy's a much harder proposition because Italy can defend, which is the main thing, and Italy can score goals, which is the other main thing. Mm. Maybe not Immobile right now. He's kind of all over the shop. But Chiesa's the danger, right? Because if you get, as we've seen repeatedly now, if you give him even literally half a yard of space, he'll shoot, and he'll shoot early. And when you shoot early, you unbalance goalkeepers. You unbalance especially short goalkeepers that don't have long arms. If you shoot, hit the corner, is he going to be able to get there? I don't know, right? That's the main problem. That Chiesa's a big worry. Insigne has been dominating everybody this tournament, except for at Spain, because what Spain did... was Koke marked Marco Verratti out of the game, basically. And then Pedri did the same to Jorginho. So they couldn't attack. And then there was no spin at solo. That's a huge loss, by the way. That's a big, big loss. And I really wish he was playing the final because he's been great. Emerson is good. He's not spin at solo, right? That's the first thing. So they're the same, that trio, Verratti, spin at solo, and Insigne was killing everybody. It was also Locatelli spin at solo. And without that, Insigne was isolated. So if England can get Insigne isolated, maybe that can help. But the main worry that you have to have for England is that midfield. Because there's only one midfield in the world capable of doing to Italy what happened to them in the semi-final. And that was the Spanish midfield. No other midfield can do that to Italy. Mm. Maybe you could argue Argentina. Maybe. But even then, Argentina got so many other problems, whatever. Spain's midfield is brilliant. England's midfield is not... There's no Sergio Busquets in England. There's no Pedri in England, right? You've got three Kokes in midfield, basically, right? Now, what that does mean is, and I said this earlier in the pod, England can press Italy all day long. I have a feeling, well, I'm not feeling, I'm almost 100% certain, Mount, Rice and Phillips will be the midfield three. Mount will press Jorginho. Rice will make sure that Barella doesn't escape, and Calvin Phillips will go on Verratti. And that's the killer, because I think Mount can press... Jorginho out of the game because he knows him from Chelsea. The key battle in the game is going to come down to Marcelo Bielsa versus Mauricio Pochettino. It's Leeds versus PSG. It's Calvin Phillips versus Marco Verratti. That's going to decide the game. Whoever wins that battle decides the game, because if Leeds dominate Verratti, Italy are not getting the ball out, right? And then England can keep them penned in. Raheem Sterling running at those old men. We saw what Morata did to Chiellini and Bonucci. Sterling can do the same thing. Kane is... just on some sort of blessed luck thing where he's playing terribly, but he's scoring goals. So when you're doing that, you've got to say hats off to the guy. So he's a danger regardless, right? And then Bukayo Saka will probably start again. Although, frankly, with Spinazzola out, you don't really need Bukayo Saka. This really would be a game to start Jadon Sancho. Let's see if he does. I don't know. But there are options, right? Jadon Sancho, Jack Grealish, Marcus Rashford. And we haven't had a Marcus Rashford moment yet, by the way. Again, I said this before. We haven't had one. There could be one coming. So... I think England will do it. I think Phillips will win the battle with Verratti. Because, I mean, I'm a notorious anti-Verratti person. And as good as he is, and he is brilliant, by the way. I think Phillips will win that battle. And I think, as a result, Italy's midfield will be neutered. Now, England won't do anything with the ball like Spain did because they aren't Spain. But they will have it. They will neuter Italy enough that the game will just sort of peter along, nothing really happening until Sterling goes, boom, and decides it. I don't know if he'll score the goal or get the assist. I think he'll get the assist from Marcus Rashford. That's my weird little headcanon. But I think that basically England will neuter Italy's midfield to the point where Mancini will have to do some sort of weird substitution thing. And as we saw against Spain, his subs were kind of weird. So, yeah, I think the pressing of the England midfield will neuter the Italian midfield, and I think England will win it just about 1-0. Marcus Rashford.
I'm gonna stick with Alan. I stuck with Alan in the semis, and I'm sticking with him in the final, mainly because I've seen how Ewan almost choked on it, and I don't want to put myself in danger of choking on saying that England are going to do it. And I do agree with Alan. You look at this Italy team: Chiellini, Bonucci, Verratti, Immobile, Belotti as well. They look as if they will die on the pitch if that's what it takes to win this. But I do think it will go the full distance. But I would just tip for Italy to win Euro 2020. That's enough for Europe. We're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're jumping across to South America and the Copa America final, which, based on the amount of attention on the Euros this summer, has gone a little bit under the radar. But Mo has been up all hours covering it, and he's going to give us the latest picture on what to expect in Messi versus Neymar. We'll catch you in a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 podcast. Obviously, in part one, the big focus is that huge game at Wembley on Sunday night. England against Roberto Mancini and Italy. But before we get stuck into that on Sunday night, we are treated in the early hours of Sunday morning to the spectacle that is the Copa America final. Brazil up against Argentina. They do not come much bigger than this. Mo, you've been covering this extensively for Squawker. It's been keeping you up till 5-6 o'clock in the morning. But in reality, you've been absolutely loving it. They're both powered through the group stages, 10 points each from 4 games. A couple of sticky moments in the knockout stages, but everybody, whether you're Brazilian, Argentinian, Scottish, English, Irish, everybody wants this final. Messi, Neymar, Brazil, Argentina. What's the picture going into the final?
It's like a rematch almost, because I know last year Argentina lost in the semi. Last Copa America 2019, Argentina lost to Brazil, but it was in the semi-final. But that felt like the final, right? It was like whoever was going to win that was going to de facto win the thing. And they played each other in the final in 2007. And of course, 2014 should have given us a Brazil-Argentina World Cup final in Brazil, which didn't happen because Brazil lost their goddamn minds against the Germans. Ruined it for us. Goddamn you, Brazil. Anyway, never forgiven David Luiz for that. Never forgiven him. But anyway, look, it happened, right? So what the mood is just Brazil look unstoppable is the first thing. Not good. I need to be very clear on this. Not good. Brazil have been awful. I mean, I think Ewan's been up watching their games as well. If you watch Brazil, you're thinking this team are rubbish. They're not going to win any games. And then because they have Neymar and because Lucas Paqueta has sort of discovered his goal, he's like scored 2 goals, 2 knockout games. They're rubbish to watch. They're awful. They're a horrible, nasty, negative side, except for when Neymar's on the ball. Then it's magic. Then literally it all comes alive. It's like he's genuinely spellbinding this tournament. He has been amazing. Colombia tried to kill him, I'm pretty sure, and he's carried on playing, was effective. Brazil have been winning. They've won all the games except for one, the dead rubber against Ecuador, which they rested half their team for. No, their whole team except for Marquinhos, sorry. Look, they're really, really boring to watch. They're really effective. They've got Edison or Alisson. It probably will be Alisson actually in goal because they've been rotating goalies all tournament just to sort of flex on everybody. And so I think Alisson will probably get a shot in goal ahead of Edison, who played in the semi-final and the quarterfinal. The defense is really solid. Marquinhos, Thiago Silva, they've got Danilo right back, who many forget was in the same Santos team that won the Libertadores as Neymar in 2011. Renan Lodi tend to be left back. I mean, but it could also be Alexandro, who also was in that Santos team. You know, it's not... And look, the best way to describe the Brazil team is that Casemiro and Fred both play together at the base midfield. What the hell do you need Casemiro and Fred? Fred is just rubbish, a rubbish version of Casemiro. And you don't need more than one Casemiro, surely. Well, you wouldn't do normally in a normal football team that keeps possession and maintains the ball, controls midfield. But Brazil are like, nah, you're all right. Just, you know, those two work their socks off to cover for everybody. And then they let the front four just sort of do what they want. They had Gabriel Jesus playing right wing, got sent off for a Lukang flying kick. So I don't think he'll be available. Is it a multiple match ban, or is he back now from the ban? I'm sure it's a...
No, he's banned for the final. He's banned for the final.
Yeah. It's because of violent conduct, right? So he's out. So that means Everton will probably start in the final. Richarlison will probably lead the line, which is as absurd as it sounds. I love Richarlison, but what the hell? He should not be striking for Brazil. It's all about Neymar. They're very rugged, very defensive side. But the thing is, the thing about them that makes them so dangerous is they just keep going. They just keep going. They just stop you, and then they just push forward, and they have a world-class... It's kind of, in a weird way, a mirror version of England, except that they don't have the capability to play better football because they haven't called up the right kind of players, and TJ is not that kind of coach at all. So it's like a weird sort of mirror of England, whereas Argentina, for the first time since probably 2007... when they lost to Brazil in the final, have actually a functioning team. The first time since the Peckerman days, they have an actual function. It's not just give it to Messi and pray, which is what it has been. Yeah, they've got actually really, really good midfield. I mentioned it earlier. Leandro Paredes will play at the base midfield, or Guido Rodriguez if they want to go muscle for muscle, but probably Leandro Paredes. Rodrigo de Paul, really, really fantastic dribbler, probably on the way to Atletico Madrid. If you watch De Paul, honestly, sensational dribbler of the ball, great worker, great hustler. Gio Lo Celso, who Premier League fans will think of not much of, but he's actually quite brilliant. Really, really great passer. His pass, the pre-assist for the goal in semi-final against Colombia was out of this world. He's a great passer, great dribbler, and that midfield gives Argentina... It means the ball is no longer Messi. He doesn't have to come to the halfway line to get the ball to start attacks. He can do if he wants, doesn't have to. And Argentina look really, really good until that final thing because they don't have a striker. They've got Aguero, who plays up front. It's not very lethal. Lautaro Martinez is sort of coming into his own, but he's not always getting the consistent chances because, not as much because they don't have a striker. Sorry, that was really what I shouldn't say. They don't have a third forward, right? It's Messi and it's Lautaro, and that works. But then who's the third guy? They've been playing Nico Gonzalez, who is just awful. And Aguero comes, Di Maria comes off the bench, and he's quite bright, but only in patches. So Argentina haven't scored as many goals as they should have. They should have scored more goals for the possession they have for the football they play. And of course, the other thing Argentina have is the problem is unless Cristian Romero of Atalanta, by the way, Atalanta are having a storming summer with the Atalanta boys all playing. Atalanta, Cristian Romero, if he isn't playing in defence, which he might not be, he was injury worried, injury doubt, then probably for some reason Scalone's going to pick Pezzella and Otamendi. And that is just as chaotic as it sounds. You know, the potential for error in there is great. But the one thing Argentina have, for once, the first time in maybe in forever, is they have a goalie that can really bail them out. And we saw this in the shootout against Colombia with Emi Martinez. Aston Villa's Emi Martinez, the man that Arsenal decided to sell ahead of Bird Leno. Aston Villa is just, he's a titan. He's a colossus. We talked about Donnarumma being a colossus. Emi Martinez might be even more of a colossus, might be like the super colossus. The ultra mega colossus, hyper giga colossus, city destroying anime mech style colossus, just amazing. In that shootout, taunting the Colombians, like just yelling at them, like, "Go on, you're going to miss, aren't you? You're going to miss," like just monumental.
We're going to spin back to Argentina in a second, obviously, because Messi is their big story. But I wanted to look at Brazil just for a second.
Oh God, yeah, Alan. Messi.
But yeah, well, you know, it's easy to forget about him. He's a bit of a sideline character. Alan, when you look at Brazil, there is oddly an Everton flavour to it. They've got Everton. They've actually got Everton in the team. And Richarlison, as Mo said, who's likely to be leading the line. And from a Premier League perspective, you look at the Brazil team and, as Mo said, it's more functional and rugged and it's based on just battling and getting the ball forward to Richarlison and to Neymar to try and win matches. Richarlison is going to have a huge amount on his shoulders going into this game because he is going to take on the burden of leading the line and taking on probably the goal threat of Jesus as well. You see enormous amount of him for Everton and you know, we know Evertonians are huge fans of him and think that he's able to do this. Are you confident of him going into this game that he can be the match winner?
Yeah, I think he's a really good foil to Neymar, to be honest. I think he's a really hard runner. He presses really, really well. And he dovetails well with Neymar in many ways, I think, you know. I prefer him to Gabriel Jesus. I think Jesus is a better finisher to him. But I think that Richarlison doesn't have the same kind of self-consciousness that Jesus does have. I think Richarlison relishes playing for Brazil and he's no fear. And I think that's what makes him key. I think he's very much a teachy player because, as Mo pointed out very correctly, they are a bit like England in many ways in the way they set up their football team. They kind of play for results. They're definitely not the Joga Bonito that people who tune in for the final few games of the Copa America might confuse them with. They're very much not. They're more Catenaccio.
Oh, they're going to be so confused if you show
it. Yeah. I think it was Roy Nemmer who tweeted that.
What? Yeah. This is Brazil?
Yeah, exactly. I think Brazil could be, as I said in the last podcast, I think, Ken, was it off air or was it on air? I think they could be a show for the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Just because of they're accustomed to the conditions. I think Chiche is a really competent coach. I think they have a very good crop of players who buy into his plan. And I think that Neymar is finally beginning to grow up and beginning to, you know, prove himself as a top talent. I think that he realizes his chances now. He's only a few goals behind Pele in the all-time Seleção scoring records. But he's no title's name. Of course, he wasn't at the 2019 Copa America. He was injured. So I think that, you know, obviously the Messi story of him winning his first major title as an Argentina player is gigantic. And that will be the main story on Saturday evening / Sunday morning. But I think that Neymar's ambition to prove that he can win something, that he's not just a flat track bully, is also a big story, you know. I think also, just as a final point to Argentina, I think Mo was spot on when he said about Leandro Paredes. I think he's been really important for Argentina. And he spoke before the tournament or during the tournament that he realized that, you know, because he plays for Neymar or PSG and Messi for Argentina, and he realized that you can't just give the ball to him no matter what. They have to be in a good position. And it's a very, very subtle mentality change, but a very important one. Give the ball to Neymar when he's in the best position and Messi. You can't just give it to him for no reason, you know? So I think that they're learning that. I think Brazil are learning that about Neymar, and Argentina are learning about Messi. And I think it's a big change.
Looking at Messi, obviously, Ewan, we've kept him quiet so far in this little segment, but, you know, the best player on earth, you can't really keep him quiet for too long. And he definitely hasn't been quiet. If you haven't seen the video / meme yet of him screaming at Yerry Mina, telling him to dance now for him after he missed his penalty against Argentina to get Messi and co into the final. It's so easy to forget, given the success that Messi's had at Barcelona individually and collectively for Barcelona, that not winning a major international title does weigh on him and the Argentinian media and public and fan base, despite the fact that he is incredible, are never too slow in reminding him that he hasn't. The drive that we're seeing from him at this tournament, in comparison to the last 12 months at Barcelona, where he's been almost grudgingly excellent, because we know the fallout from last summer when he wanted to leave. He's pretty much just kind of got himself knuckled down and had another messy season where Barcelona came relatively close to hauling back Atletico. He wants this. We can talk about Brazil and Neymar and structure and setup. When do you have Messi in this mood? Even for Barcelona, I'm struggling to remember the last time I saw Messi in this mood. When he is in this mood and has this mentality, there's no stopping him.
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at pure numbers. In six games, he's got 4 goals and 5 assists, but this tournament, he's been so much more than that. But it's not because, like Mo pointed out, it's not because Argentina are trying deliberately to get him the ball at every opportunity. He's having the ball a normal amount of time. He's just making something happen every single time. Didn't score in the semi-final, but a great assist there for Lautaro to score. So he's just absolutely plugged in. It's a good question. I don't know the last time he was like this. I mean, he's been consistently great forever, so it's not like he's not been reaching this level. He's had so many
great months.
But this anger, I think it might be after the 2014 World Cup final, that treble year with Luis Enrique, that sort of end to that season, where the Bayern Munich semi-final, when he went, they won the treble, when he came back angry. Because I think after they lost that final in 2014, you thought, right, Messi's won everything. This was a big blow. How is he going to respond? That season, he just came back and played with, yeah, like you say, that sort of anger. I don't know why he seems so angry and right now, but maybe just it's been a very frustrating, not just season at Barcelona, a couple of seasons, you know. So I think he's just determined. And you see, if you've not watched the penalty shootout yet, watch it and try and find some of the other footage where they're looking at Messi, looking at him, his reactions. He calls out Yerry Mina, are you dancing now? That's hilarious. But even just every other strike, he's, you know, fist pumping. He's even advancing like 4 meters after every goal scored, and his penalty himself was just absolutely top class, with a lot of anger in that too. So he's plugged in, he's angry, and he's going up against Brazil now, who gave him a bit of a kicking last time, so we'll see.
2014-15 was the last time we saw Messi as angry, because in that summer they obviously they 2014 they lost the World Cup final, and that 2015 they made the Copa del Copa America final against Chile, and they lost the shootout. They lost 3-1. Messi was the only one that scored his penalty, and Messi was brilliant. And Higuain, of course, had a second sitter in a row, second of three sitters in three summers, and they should have won then. After that, something inside Messi was like, ooh. And the next season, he changed a bit. He was much more of a playmaker, and everyone kept missing chances for him. And so he lost that sort of anger because he was sort of let Neymar take over, and then he missed. In the 2016, it's let Suarez take over. Sorry, Suarez was the main goal scorer, 2015-16 at Barca. And then so Messi sort of didn't fade, but he became more of a playmaker, and he lost that sort of anger, that edge. And he's got that back now. Like you said, he's absolutely got that back. Even to a degree, even at the end of the season for Barcelona, you could see that anger in him. There was little flashes of it. You're like, oh, hang on a minute. What's this? Where's this come from? And he went hero Messi again, which we hadn't seen him in a while. And then, yeah, at the tournament. Do you know what it is, though, about the yelling at Yerry Mina? To give context to this, Yerry Mina scored his penalty shootout against Uruguay. Scored in the shootout against Uruguay. Scored his penalty. And then did a dance. Like, treating it like a normal goal. And it was very strange. And I can't help but think that Luis Suarez was standing there very, very angry and disrespected about it. Especially because Uruguay then lost, right? So Luis Suarez is one of Messi's like best chum. It would not surprise me if they were on WhatsApp later that night saying, I can't believe what this freaking guy did. He just danced. I'm so angry at him. And Messi's just had a little bit of revenge for his chum there. Go on, dance now. Because Yerry Mina wasn't like doing anything especially egregious to Messi. To be fair, he did foul Messi like two or three times quite hard in the game. But it was still nothing that you would think Messi would get that fired up about. But I think Suarez had been in his ear a little bit or in his DMs just saying, can't believe this guy. And then Messi's already fired up. Then Yerry Mina fouls him a few times. And so he just flips out and is like, go on, dance now. Dance. It was great. It was like, what the hell? Where's this guy come from? But he's been amazing. He's the best player in the world. And it's just, he's playing like the best player in the world.
And also, Messi isn't someone who has a very good relationship with Brazil and the Brazilian authorities. After the last Copa America, he was quite explicit in saying that, you know, they're kind of working in coalition with Brazil to get them the competition. The fact that Brazil are hosting it this summer, despite all the political issues, despite the COVID issues there, is another kind of maybe black mark in his mind. And I think that Messi, maybe he's watched The Last Dance, I don't know, but he's definitely in that kind of MJ, you know, I'm taking this personal, we're going to get you. Yeah. And while, of course, we know he maintains that WhatsApp group with Neymar and Luis Suarez, I think that he won't hesitate in running over Neymar on Saturday night if it means he can win the trophy, you know? I mean, Argentina won since 1993. I think he's going to be on fire. And I think that if you're not watching that game, if you're not staying up until whatever 1 a.m. it is in the UK, I think you have to question you look at yourself in the mirror, because like it's like everything you want. Neymar versus Messi, everything at stake at the Maracanã. It's phenomenal. I for one can't wait.
Right, we're going to try and put a lid on this. Ewan, we'll go to you first. The most non-Brazilian Brazil side ever up against Michael Jordan / Lionel Messi, who is absolutely starving for this. How is it going to go down?
Yeah, I think Argentina do it. But, you know, be careful. Watch out. If Brazil score first, if they go ahead, they can grind out a 1-0 win. They've done that already. They can grind it out. So watch out for that. But I don't think that'll happen. I think Argentina will score first and win the game. So I'm going to Argentina.
Mo, where are you going? Messi or Neymar?
Argentina have conceded 3 goals in this tournament. Brazil have conceded 2. Ewan's right. If Brazil go 1-0 up, it's bad news. It's bad, bad news for Argentina. They will just happily sit back and they will counter. And Neymar running at Germán Pezzella is not something anyone wants for Argentina. But again, Argentina play much better football. They have a cohesive midfield. Angel Di Maria is fit. And when Angel Di Maria has been fit, he's not been fit for any of those 3 finals that Argentina lost, 2014, 15 or 16. He wasn't there. He's the other player that you can trust. Lautaro Martinez is fit, firing in good form. 3 goals in his last 3 games. He's a clutch striker. He's not Gonzalo Higuain. All right? I think Argentina do the business. I think Messi has been living for this his whole life. He would give away every Barca medal to win something with Argentina. Genuinely, he would. He loves it. People forget this because they'll say, oh, he raised in Spain. He loves his country so much. It's honestly ridiculous. And he is living for this his entire life, footballing life. This is building up to this and then next year. His last shots to win both these things. He'll be too old probably in 2024 when the next Copa comes around. This is his last shot. Like Adam says, it's the last dance, right? He's going to do it. He's going to get it done. Him, Messi, Lautaro, De Paul, Lo Celso, Acuna, you know, Paredes, Argentina got what it takes. They'll do it.
Alan, fairy tale ending. Are you going to tie it up? Messi's hands on the trophy, finally.
Yeah, I think Mo is spot on with Messi's love for Argentina. I think, you know, he preserves his Rosarino accent, even though he's been in Barcelona since he was 12 or 13 years old. He's almost like one of those Irish people who goes to Irish pubs wherever they go, because he's not in Ireland, he's not in Argentina. He's almost over-egging the Argentineness, you know, with his mate and all that kind of thing. I think he'll kill for this trophy. My head says Brazil, just because of how strong they are, of how kind of almost a colossus they are, because Brazilian football is aeons ahead of everywhere else in Latin America, structurally, financially, in the club game. It's just so much bigger and stronger than everything else. So my head says Brazil, but my heart says Argentina and Messi. And when I have to choose between my intellect and my instinct, I always go for my instinct. So I'm going to join the lads in going full house for Argentina and Lionel Messi.
Yeah, and let's face it, Messi's not exactly famous for bottling it. So yeah, I'm going to go 4-4, which is nice to have a little bit of agreement. It's been rare that we've agreed with each other, particularly in the knockout stages. Hopefully, Messi can do it. But in reality, whichever way it goes this weekend, we are in for two enormous, enormous games. And whatever happens, Europe and South America will have a brand new champion by this time next week. So probably not much sleep for any of us for the next few days, but let's be realistic, you wouldn't have it any other way. Mo, Ewan, Alan, thanks so much for your time.
Cheers, mate. I'm going to sleep the hell afterwards, mate. Once it's all over, I'm having a week of sleep for a whole week.
Thanks, Virgil. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Fantastic stuff. And don't forget, we will be back next week when the tournament is over with a review show, looking back at the best players, top goal scorer, biggest moments, and talking about the brand new champion of Europe. Will it be England or will it be Italy? Check out next week's show and we will be discussing who has got their hands on that big, big trophy. We'll catch you again very, very soon.